Hey, folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley right here for you. I'm on vacation this week. I am somewhere where it's hopefully sunny and warm. At least that's the idea. And I hope you enjoyed Mike Sin filled in for me this morning if you listened on the radio. But I've got an encore presentation of the podcast today. This originally aired. It was a live interview May 23rd, 2009. Big Jim Sullivan. Of course, he's passed away since this interview, so it's kind of tragic. But this guy plays on so many amazing records. And we play some of them in the show. So you might want to head over to WFMU.org/Michael and listen to the whole program, which has all the music, but this one has there's a few little snippets at the end of this of some of Big Jim's work, but it's just a sweet interview. Nice guy, like I said, so many great records, and a listener in California asked me to rebroadcast this one. So if you've got an idea for an encore presentation for the podcast, you can email me michaels@wfmu.org. I'm not sure what's coming up, so check. Always just keep your eye over at wfmu.org/Michael. There's always a list there of what's coming up. All right, hopefully I'm back next week safe and sound and suntanned, not sunburned. Here is the great Big Jim Sullivan. Yes, there is the amazing Thunderclap Newman featuring the amazing Big Jim Sullivan. It's just an amazing body of work. Big Jim, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's just, I'm looking over the list of songs, and it is really mind-blowing. You must hear yourself on the radio every single day.
Yeah, more than once.
Does it get old, or is it always exciting?
No, not really anymore.
Just there.
And it's great. It's great to feel that you've left your mark.
Yeah. You were born in Uxbridge, Middlesex, England. And I believe that's 1941. When did you pick up the guitar? When did music become part of your life?
1940.
Oh, yeah. And right away...
I'm only joking. When I was about 13, I picked up the guitar.
And what? Why? What was there? Something on the radio? Was it?
I think, I think it was the rock and roll that started. Bill Haley was being played, you know, and various things like that. It was on. Well, it was on film anyway. The Blackboard Jungle had made its rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all dancing up the aisles of the cinema and all that, driving to Bill Haley, you know.
Yeah.
It was solo in Rock Around the Clock, which totally fascinated.
Yeah, it's a fantastic guitar solo. I'm sure it inspired many. So how long did it take till you figured out that this was something you were good at?
It never really kind of entered my mind. It was something that... One thing just led to another, and all of a sudden, you know, within a couple of years, I was a professional musician.
Huh. Great. So did you ever have to have another job, you know, apprenticing or doing something else, or was that it?
I did work at Parke Davis. It's a chemicals firm for a brief period.
You hooked up, I think one of the first guys was Marty Wilde in the Wildcats, right?
Right, yeah. I was 17 when I joined Marty. Yeah.
17 years old. And what was the scene like? I mean, what was the demand for gigs at that time?
Well, Marty did lots of tours. I mean, there were these small cinemas, especially up north, called the Star Circuit. And we used to do these tours around the Star Circuit cinema. And that obviously led on to other tours down south and all over England, in fact.
So this is 1959 or so. Was it the kind of show where you're playing three songs 15 times a day, or is it one proper long set?
No, we just did one set with Marty.
Hmm. And at that time, you're playing a gold-top Gibson guitar that used to belong to Rosetta Tharpe. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of great YouTube footage of her playing that same guitar, and she's an amazing guitar player. Where did he get the guitar?
Well, Monty got it from Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
just bought it off her?
Yeah, I believe so.
Hmm.
And, you know, I took it over from Marty. And in 59, when the American guitars started coming over here, I got myself a Gibson 345.
And what did you do with Sister Rosetta Tharpe's guitar?
I sold it back to Marty.
That's probably worth $8 million now, you know.
Yeah, it's worth a lot of money, that guitar. Yeah. If it's still around anywhere, if anybody's still got that. In fact, I asked Marty if he still had it, and he said no.
Hmm. Yeah, so I didn't realize there was a point where American guitars just simply weren't available in the U.K., is that right?
Well, not until 1959.
That explains a lot. It's very interesting. Yeah, it is interesting how nowadays, you know, 90% of bands use two or three brands of guitars, but back then there were lots and lots of brands and everybody had a different shape guitar.
Well, yeah, on the British scene there were a few handmade guitars which looked a bit like a Strat or a 335 or something like that. But the real things were very rare. Mm. I mean, my 345 was the first one in the country.
Mm. The Wildcats also backed up Eddie Cochran, is that right?
Yes, we did, yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, that was great, because Eddie was great, you know. I mean, he was a great musician. He was a musician first and foremost, really.
Mm.
And he was also a great singer. We originally were supposed to back Gene Vincent, and of course I knew I was raised on Cliff Gallup and that, and Gene Vincent when I was a kid, you know, and I knew all the solos, so I thought, oh, that's great. But when Eddie came, I was a bit disappointed, actually. But when we actually met Eddie and he started playing guitar, you know, we thought, oh, wow, you know, this is something else.
He's real. And that, and Gene Vincent had his accident, right? That's why that didn't go over?
Well, Gene Vincent had an accident before he came over to England. That's how he got the irons on the legs.
Mm. So how did you make the transition from that to becoming, you know, one of the most in-demand session guys? How did that happen? And did it sort of, it seems to me that it happened at the same time that the British record industry sort of started booming as well.
When I joined Marty, we did his first album called Wild About Marty. And, of course, you know, I could bend the strings and all that sort of thing, and nobody else did that over here. But, of course, I couldn't read, so that stopped it a bit. But there were guys who were still willing to use me. So all, right from the start, Jack Good used me on most of his studio recordings.
And word just got around.
And word got around from there, you know.
Yeah, was there like a strange, you know, the older school guys who had grown up playing jazz or playing sort of, you know, music hall, show music, and could read music, you know, obviously they wanted to make money playing rock and roll, but was there a weird resentment between that generation and your generation?
There was, yes. Yeah, there was a bit of resentment, but some of the older guys were really good, you know, guys like Eric Ford, who used to play on the TV show Jack Good, the one that Marty did, Oh Boy.
Mm.
And you know, there were various guitarists around who played Judd Proctor, for instance, very high class English jazz guitar player, you know. Ike Isaacs. A few of these guys kind of took me under their wing, you know, and kind of put me on the right track, as it were.
And did you eventually learn to read?
Oh, yeah.
And at that point, you could just pretty much come in and play anything?
Well, I tell you what started me to read. Somebody called me, a guy called Harry Benson, who was one of the British... There was only two British bookers for session. One was Charlie Katz, one was Harry Benson. And he booked me for this session at Elstree Studios, a film session. And he told me it was a rock and roll thing. And I said, look, I can't read. I can read chords, you know. But I can't, I can read, but I can't read fast. You know, I can't sight read.
Mm.
Oh, don't worry about that. I get to the session, 75-piece orchestra and three guitars. There was Judd Proctor, Ernie Shears, and myself. And I was on the third guitar part, rhythm guitar part. So I thought, oh, that's great. That's okay. I should make this. And when I got my part, all my chords were written in notation.
Yeah.
There was one chord on the whole piece. And a couple of times through, of course, I couldn't read it, you know. So a voice came down from the box upstairs in the studio and said, would the third guitar player kindly pack his gear and go home? In front of all of these musicians.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was, what, 17? Anyway, to cut a long story short, Judd Proctor, who picked me up to take me to the studio, took me back again, took me home. And he said, get all of the things like Bach, all of the single line studies, flute studies, violin studies, anything that's single line, that's continuous notes, and learn to read the notes. So I did that, and he said, once you've done that, get drum parts, trumpet parts, or anything like that, and learn to read the rest. He said, it's not the notes that are the problem, it's the rest.
The rest.
The syncopation of the music, which puts everybody off, you know.
Hmm.
And that's the hardest thing. Anyway, I did 6 months. And after 6 months, this Harry Benson called me again to do a session. And I did the session. And it happened to be this same conductor that kicked me off the other session. And it was a Latin American. He's very well known for his Latin American stuff. His name was Stanley Black. Oh. And I just shot through this part, you know, I just sight read it. And he came up to me afterwards and said to me, that was fantastic. I really, I'll have to use you again. He said, but have we met before? And I nearly said to him, yeah, I'm the guy you throw off the session. But I said, no, we haven't.
Wow.
That's how I learned to read.
That's an amazing story. And it's not so easy to do when, you know, it's like a language. It's harder to do as you get older, I think.
Yeah. If you have a bit of guidance, you know, like I had a bit of guidance from these guys. And any time, the great thing about sessions were all the musicians were top guys. So if there was anything you wanted to know, whether it be technical, you know, whether it be musical, whatever, there was somebody to answer your question.
Hmm.
You know, so consequently, I learned in leaps.
Yeah, I guess so. All those teachers in one room. So let's talk about what it was like. I mean, what was the typical day like for you? I mean, how, at your busiest, what was the schedule like?
Oh, God. I mean, I've done days like Rolling Stones in the morning. They were used to they used to use me on doing all their demos.
Hmm.
So it'd be the Rolling Stones in the morning. In the afternoon, I don't know, it could be anybody, you know, from the Tremolos to Kathy Kirby to Tom Jones to you name it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the evening, I might have a session at Decca 3 Studios doing these quadraphonic Decca albums, you know, with Frank Chaxfield, you know, 80, 90-piece orchestras.
Hmm. And when you walk in to do, you know, a Tremolos record or just, you know, one of the thousands of records that you made, would there be a chart? Would you hear a demo of the song? Would the singers run it down with you? Or how would the whole thing start?
More often than not, we got a chord chart.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit in the studio with the singers and just run through with the arranger, you know, because the arranger was there. And in those days, everything was live. Strings as well, you see.
Hmm. So, the singer live as well?
Huh? The singer was live as well, yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, well, it's only on two-track machines, you see. We only had two-track. It wasn't until, like, 62, 63 that four-track came in.
Hmm. And it must be have been kind of amazing to walk in and not know if you were going to cut, you know, an obscure track that would be on, you know, the second to last song on an album or a number one hit. You know, you never knew from one day to the next.
Well, it's true. Well, it was only a couple of years ago that I found out I did David Bowie's first album.
Yeah, you're not on the credits for it, I'm pretty sure.
No, I know. But it was Herbie Flowers that told me.
He said you were there. So did you keep a notebook? Do you have any sort of record that you kept?
No. It was a bit unfortunate because I wish we had with all this PPL business and all that, you know. But no, we didn't. You know, I mean, you never knew anyway. The fix would call you and say, "Jim, got a session for you. Turn to a one EMI. It's on. You'll need your 12 string and your acoustic and your electric. So there'll be doubling in it, you know." Mm.
And how much did a regular session pay, a three-hour session?
£7.
£7, wow. Well, I guess you had to work a lot, three sessions.
Yeah.
So one of the problems I had sort of researching things and was I found a lot of contradictory evidence that, you know, one list would say that you play on a record, another list would say it was Jimmy Page or some other guitar player that played on a record. It must be frustrating in some ways to not have a definitive record.
Well, let's put it this way. Jimmy knows what he played on and I know why.
Yeah. I'm going to name some artists and, you know, just give me a couple of sentences about what each guy or each person or each session was like. Tell me a little bit about Dave Barry.
Dave, on the first thing I did with Dave, which was My Baby Left Me, that was the first session I ever did with Jimmy Page.
Hmm.
And Jimmy played lead on that and I played rhythm. But on, what's the...
Are you on Crying Game or Little Things?
On Crying Game, I did the lead, yeah.
Oh, that sort of wah-wah volume pedal guitar?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, great thing. Let's talk about Lulu. What a small ball of energy.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
I remember when she came in the studio, I think she was only 14. And we did Shout. BC Studios in Regent Street. That was with Jack Good.
Jack Good produced that. Marianne Faithfull's As Tears Go By, you play on that, right?
Yeah. The original thing of Tears Go By for the Stones. The original demo.
Oh, interesting. What about all those Herman's Hermits cuts? Do you play on all of those?
Most of them.
And what was Mickey Most like? He produced most of those records. What kind of a guy was he? What kind of a producer was he?
He was a good producer.
Yeah,
he was a good producer. He kind of let us down at the latter end of things by saying that we didn't play on certain titles, but you know, he knows we did, and we know we did, and so Urban. So,
was there ever a situation where you would come in and play on a Herman's Hermits records, and you know, Herman's Hermits was an actual band with musicians in it who went out and played live concerts? Was there resentment from the guys in the band you were replacing?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I had a thing a few years ago, about 4 years ago. One of the guys, a guitar player, phoned me up from Herman's Hermits and, "How are you, Jim?" and all that sort of thing. And he eventually, you know, it came to why he called. He called because he said, "I didn't play on the Herman's Hermits tracks."
Hmm.
So I said to him, "Well, you've got a short memory, because if you remember, you came over to my house in Woodside Park and I taught you the solo that I played on the record." I mean, things like that happen in this business, which is a shame, you know.
Well, How can you explain to people listening how it is that, you know, whoever that guy was, but a band like Hermits Hermits that had been together for years and maybe even rehearsed songs over and over again, guys like you could still come in having never heard the song and do something just a little bit different that was better for the record?
That's why we worked. That's why we worked. That's why the people called on me to do that, exactly that.
Yeah.
Make up something, you know. Can you make up something here? Can you play a solo, you know? And that's why, you know, people like myself and all the other session guys, that's why we worked like we did. We were doing three sessions a day for 7 days a week, you know, months in and months out.
Yeah, it's amazing. The amount of records you made is amazing. Freddie and the Dreamers, Billy J. Kramer, Peter and Gordon, Dave Clark Five, The Searchers, Dusty Springfield, Wayne Fontana, The Fortunes, Petula Clark, Walker Brothers, Los Bravos, The Seekers. It goes on and on really forever. It's almost every song in the top 40 in the 60s in the UK.
Well, that's what happened. That's what happened, you know. I mean, we, as I say, you know, we could be doing Dusty Springfield in the morning, Herman's in the afternoon, you know, and whoever at night.
Mm. What about The Kinks, You Really Got Me? Do you play on that one?
No, I don't. Well, in actual fact, I think I did play on that because I was called in to overdub some guitar.
Mm.
And so I think, but I don't say I played on it, I say no, because that was Dave anyway.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's Jimmy Page on rhythm guitar and Dave certainly on lead guitar. But it is odd that that's a record that you do get credited with once in a while. What about The Zombies, She's Not There? Do you play on that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What an amazing sounding record that is. Were there records that you got excited about because they were so good?
Oh.
I mean, I know everybody was a professional, but when a great record or a great performance come, did everybody's, you know, did it get kicked up a little bit, the excitement?
Yeah, you know, we all get in the box and listen to the recordings back, you know, and we all turn around and say, yeah, that's a hit, you know.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know what I mean? It's, but, you know, the excitement is taken out of it a bit when we walk off with our £7 or when it went up £12 in the 60s. And 3 months later, we see the artist that we've just worked for driving in his Rolls Royce.
Yeah, well, that was I was going to ask you about that. I mean, it's a strange business, yeah.
But that was our job.
Yeah.
That was our job, you know, and I earned a good living, you know. I had a nice house and a couple of cars and a nanny for my kids and all that sort of thing. So, you know, it was a good era for me and the guys like me.
Hmm. When the Beatles came, I mean, you're one of the few guys that had a demonstrably decade really in the business before the Beatles came along. What did you think when you first heard them and? Did you realize how big it was going to be and how much it was going to change everything, including your job?
Well, I think we did, yeah. You know, we liked the Beatles. I met the Beatles real early on in the studio because I used to do a lot of work for George Martin and consequently doing work for him, the Beatles, all the guys were there at some time or other and they'd all heard of me anyway.
Hmm.
And they all wanted them. I became good friends with George and Paul. And I ended up going over to George's house on a reasonable basis and played sitar with him.
Mm. Yeah, I guess you two guys were really the two first guys to play the sitar. That led to your 1967 record Sitar Beat and the Lord Sitar album from 1968, which was made under an assumed name, Lord Sitar, with kind of fuzzy pictures, and nobody knew who Lord Sitar was exactly.
Right, I know. Yeah.
Did those records sell a lot of records at the time?
Well, they're still selling now. No, they didn't sell a lot.
Yeah, they are on a lot of compilation records. You find tracks from those records. They're very groovy. I mean, I love them. We heard a few minutes ago. Did you ever think I'm going to be a big star as a solo act?
No, never ever thought. Never ever crossed my mind. I never wanted to be.
Yeah, just knock them off and put them out there and see what happens. Yeah.
Would have liked to have made a lot more money, you know. But as far as being a star, no, I never had any pretensions about that.
Let's talk about producers. You're in a rare vantage point. Let me remind everybody, we're talking to Big Jim Sullivan, UK session guitar player on thousands of amazing chart hits. You're in a unique position, a point of view, to observe different producers at work. Were there some guys who were really on it and who really made a hit from nothing, and other guys who were just more lucky to be in the right place at the right time?
Yes, there were. You know, I mean, it's like what's their name? Stone and American guy, two American guys. Producer Decca. Can't remember their names.
Okay.
Mike Stone and somebody else. I can't remember. There were guys like that. Of course, there were guys like Peter Sullivan and George Martin, of course.
You work with Joe Meek. You work with Paul McCartney as a producer. And
Yep. Worked with Chet Atkins as a producer.
Yeah, everybody.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, all of the the big producers like Gus Dudgeon, for instance. Was a tape jock when I first met him at Decca Studios. You know, and he used to make the tea and put the and so did a few of the other younger guys who made it really big, you know.
Yeah, that is, even the Beatles guys, they all moved up the ladder, sort of.
Yeah.
It's sort of an amazing system. P.J. Proby, John Barry, Freddie and the Dreamers, Donovan. Which Donovan records do you play on? That's another one that's kind of disputed, and the credits on the records don't always seem to match what happened.
No, I know. I saw the other night, I was watching a film about Donovan, and he actually credits me on a couple of the records, Mellow Yellow and something else.
Do you play on Sunshine Superman?
Yeah,
That's very interesting. It is. It would be nice to get all of this corrected, you know.
Well, you're never going to do it.
Yeah, they never are. Yeah. Are there contracts somewhere? I mean, somewhere did there exist a slip of paper when they paid everybody? You know, that says who played on what song. You know.
No. It's not like the American system, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first came over to America, late 60s, and I got back to England, I tried to get our union to follow the American system and even form a session musicians union, you know, which they did in the late 80s, you know, but I was out of it by then.
1969, you join Tom Jones's band and sort of leave the studio and you hit the road. And he's also got a TV show, for which I want to point out there's lots of great clips on YouTube on the computer of you playing guitar with special guests and behind Tom Jones and stuff. Was it just time for a break for you, or was the studio session life winding down?
No, what happened really there was... Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were really good mates of mine, and they said they were leaving the sessions and they were going to form a band, you know. And I said, well, that's great, you know, would I be interested? No, I wouldn't be interested in anything like that, because I'm doing very well, thank you. And then I got a whole bunch of session musicians together, Barry Morgan, Alan Parker, Herbie Flowers, various people like that, all top session guys, you know, and said, we've got to lay some tracks and make an album and, you know, get out on the road because they're paying fortunes, you know, on the road for bands.
Hmm.
They said, okay, we'll get together and do the albums, but we don't want to go out on the road, you know. So I said, well, that's silly, you know. We've got to do the. We're doing both of them is where you clean up, you know, is where you get the money. Mm. Anyway, cut a long story short. At the same time, Gordon Mills came to me and made me an offer I couldn't refuse with Tom Jones, and I joined Tom. 6-8 months later, this group came out with a song called Melting Pot, Blue Mink, and that's who I formed.
So it was really more about just trying to get more pieces of the pie by going out and playing live?
Yeah.
And you were with Tom Jones for a long time. It sounds like it must have been a riot at that time. He was sort of at his height and just a very charismatic guy and lots of hit records. What could be bad about that, you know?
Oh, it's fantastic. I always say that the best 45 years of my life were the 5 years I spent with Tom Jones.
So you lived quite a bit in those 5 years, yeah?
Oh, I should say.
Oh, dear. You can write a book, perhaps, and we'll hear about it. Let me remind folks, it's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org, and Big Jim Sullivan is my guest. It really is an amazing list of records. I just keep going back to that because it's true. You talked about getting a bigger share of the pie. You started producing records, and you had a band called Tiger.
Yeah.
And you and Derek Lawrence started a label called Retreat Records.
That's right.
And was it okay being an entrepreneur, or did you ever wish I was just back in the studio where all I had to do was play my guitar?
Well, we had some great times in the studio. I mean, we actually did, Chaz and Dave's first album, you know, and then it was sold to EMI. We did a great album with Labby Siffre, who Eminem lifted some of the tracks that we did.
Right, that must have been a nice payday.
Well, it was for Labby, yeah. It wasn't for us.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I composed, I did the arrangement, you know, which Eminem lifted, but Labby got paid for it because it was his song.
Ah. I see. Then you went on to play with Olivia Newton-John, the James Last Orchestra, and then you started doing music for jingles and advertisements and stuff in the 80s, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and so that must have been a nice, you know, sort of a culmination of all of your talents sort of in one.
Well, it was, yes, because just before I joined Tom, 67, 68, 69, I was doing arrangements for the groups and things, you know. I did one for those DV, whatever their name is, Brosh and Toch.
Yeah.
Dave Dozy, yeah. Big Stitch, yeah. I did one of their hits. I did a hits for Family, arranged that. You know, there was about three or four things that I did, and I was getting known as an arranger, you know, which I quite enjoyed. But then when Tom came along, you know, in actual fact, I did some arrangements for Tom for his TV show. It kind of quietened down a bit, you know.
And now you've got, you have a duo that you go and play with, is that right?
Yes.
And folks, I think if they go to your website, BigJimSullivan.com, they can see upcoming dates, and there's a little merchandise section for folks to pick up some records and stuff there. I mean, it's, you know, you're still a relatively young man. I mean, are you still making music all the time? Are you still picking up the guitar every day?
Well, I'm 68. Unfortunately, I've got progressive heart failure, and that's kind of laid me down a little bit. But guitar is still a major part of my heart, you know. It's part of my... You can't do something for the amount of years that I've done it and then just forget it.
Yeah.
You know. I have a guitar by the side of me at all times. I don't play it much at the moment because of this thing has made me very weak, you know, physically. But I still listen, and I still want to play, you know, and I'm still trying, putting my energies into trying to play anyway.
Well, put your energies into, you know, getting well, you know, make that your priority if you can, you know. I know sometimes that does take just physical energy just to get, just to will yourself better. I want to ask you, do you have an amazing record collection? Did you buy these records when they all came out, or did you, you know?
No, I didn't. But I've got a good record collection. I've got still got all my albums that I collected when I was on the road with Marty. Because Brian Bennett, Licorice Lockin, Tony Belcher and myself were all great jazz fans, you know? And we used to collect all the Blue Note records and things like. I had in the last time I counted, which was many, many years ago, 17 versions of the Rodrigo guitar concerto.
Well, you can sell them on eBay, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, do you have some favorite sessions, just to wrap up here, things that you just remember, you know, so fondly, or records that you're just especially proud of having taken part of?
Yes, I think things like Hold Me and Together, you know, which was the first fuzz box used in this country.
Right, PJ Proby, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, Dave Berry, Crying Game. Hmm. You know, that was the first in this country using that to De'Armond foot pedal.
Hmm.
But I'd used that before on Mike Cox's Sweet Little 16. I mean, you know, there are things that you think, oh, that was good, I enjoyed that, you know, that was fantastic, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of the things, for instance, you know, doing Alone Again, you know. With
Gilbert O'Sullivan, yeah.
Because we used to do all the Gilbert O'Sullivan records, BNC was with MAMS, which is Gordon Mills, Tom Jones agency. And that was a nice night, a lovely night. When that all came together.
Yes, so. What a strange and special record that is, Alone Again, naturally, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those one-off records it spoke for itself. It was a hit all over the world.
Yeah. Well, Big Jim Sullivan, this has been a real pleasure just to get a peek inside so many great records sort of went down. And, you know, just thank you for taking a minute and visiting with us today.
Thinking of me.
Yeah, well, perhaps we'll talk again soon, because I think we've just got the tip of the iceberg here. All right, thank you, Jim.
Indeed, thank you too.
In a little while from now, if I'm not feeling any less sound, I promise myself to treat myself and visit a nearby town. Climbing to the top, will throw myself off in an effort to make clear to whoever what it's like when you're shattered, left standing in the lurch at a church where people were saying, my God, that's tough, she stood him up. No point in us remaining, we may as well go on as I did on my own, alone again. That only yesterday I was cheerful, bright and gay, looking forward to what wouldn't do, the role I was about to play. But as if to knock me down, reality came around, and without so much as a mere touch, cut me into little pieces, leaving me to doubt. Talk about God in His mercy, if He really does exist. Why did He desert me in my hour of need? I truly am indeed alone again, naturally. It seems to me that there are more hearts broken in the world that days. I remember I cried when my father died, never wishing to hide the tears. And at 65 years old, my mother, God rest her soul, couldn't understand why the only man she had ever loved had been taken, leaving her to start with a heart so badly broken. Despite encouragement from me, no words were ever spoken. When she passed away, I cried and cried all day, alone again. Naturally, alone again. Naturally.
It's Michael Shelley, Saturday on WFMU.
Out of doubt, cause baby, social world. You can't come back, be the first in line. Oh yeah, you're obsolete, my baby, my poor unfaithful baby. I said, baby, 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 you're out of time. Well, baby, 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 you're out of time. I said, baby, 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 you're out of time. Yes, you are, now. Yes, you are.
Just gotta tell her.